Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Lisa Schwartz. I'm one of the pharmacists on staff at NCTA. I'd like to welcome you to today's education webinar, Genetic Testing Coming to a Pharmacy Near You. The speaker today is Nicholas W. Newman, PharmD. After graduating from Ohio Northern University Rabe College of Pharmacy, he went on to complete a PGY1 community care residency with a primary practice site at Uptown Pharmacy, an independent pharmacy in Westerville, Ohio. He then joined the staff at Uptown and is currently working to open and take on the pharmacy manager role at another independent pharmacy, the Central Pharmacy. Dr. Newman developed an interest in pharmacogenomics during his time at Ohio Northern, and he co-founded the first collegiate student personalized medicine coalition, the SPMC. He has since gone on to present on pharmacogenomics to high school students, pharmacy technicians, and to pharmacists at the Ohio Pharmacists Association annual conference, as well as implementing a pharmacogenomics service at Uptown Pharmacy. Today's webinar is being recorded and will be provided on the NCPA website. I'll send you instructions for accessing that recording later using the same email address that you registered with here. When Dr. Newman finishes, we'll take questions from the question and answer chat box. And with that, Nick, turn it over to you.
Perfect. Thank you very much. And I want to thank everyone that's joining me today. It's very exciting for me since I usually have done this in person. This is my first webinar of genetic testing, so we're going to hope this goes okay. But I'd like to thank everyone to start out with, and I want to be respectful of your time, so I'll try to keep an eye on the time at the bottom corner of my computer. But with that, let's get going. Today I'll be talking to you about genetic testing and how you can bring that to your pharmacy. So we'll take a dive into what is genetics. We'll kind of use some terms. We'll explain those. We'll talk about some drugs that are impacted by a human genome, and then we'll kind of deviate from that and go into how can you bring genetic testing to your pharmacy or your practice site. So without further ado, we'll get started, and I have nothing to disclose here. You can see the learning objectives here in front of you, but I've already laid out the format on how we're going to get through this presentation today. So, why are we going to spend the next hour or less on pharmacogenomics? So I've put some important features here. Currently, drug manufacturers and FDA, they're bringing out information on drugs that are currently on the market. So it's being pharmacogenetic information is out there for drug development, labeling of drugs, and the approval process for drugs coming to market. Also, the ACPE released their standards for 2016 for the colleges of pharmacy across the nation, and included in those standards are pharmacogenomics and genetics. And I've taken an expert out of their standards for this year and kind of showing you what pharmacy students will be learning throughout the universities across our nation. So anyone that's graduating with a PharmD degree, they're going to have some background training in pharmacogenomics. So those of us who have graduated before this, we may not have received genetic testing or genetic information within our curriculum. Now it's going to be changing, so all the new pharmacists will have this knowledge. So the rest of us kind of got to play a catch-up game. And last but not least, pharmacies right now are currently providing genetic services. There are quite a few I know across the country that are bringing these services to their pharmacy, and their patients are benefiting from this. I also wanted to bring out an article that was released by APHA. This was back in 2011. It was called Integrating Pharmacogenomics into Pharmacy Practice via Medication Therapy Management. I took a couple of sentences and quotes from this article, and they said that pharmacists can serve an integral role in applying genomics into clinical practice. We can help our patients better, and we are kind of the perfect person to do so. One avenue they suggest bringing in service is to integrate it through medication therapy management. So across the nation, we are doing medication therapy management for our patients. They thought, hey, what a great opportunity is to add genomics into this session and our sit-downs we have with our patients. I also wanted to show you another quote. I'm not going to read this, but I highlighted a couple of important points they made in this article. They said that moving forward, they're going to charge us with defining a process on how we can incorporate genetics into our everyday life. They also want us to develop a viable business model, so making sure we're getting paid for the services we provide. And we also need to work in collaboration with other healthcare providers and labs. They don't want us to take this over. They want to make sure physicians are involved. We are working together as a team and applying these concepts to our patients in a team format. And last but not least, they want to develop technology solutions to kind of use this to incorporate genetics into our technology we use today. I can see in the future where if you look at your computer today as you're dispensing medications, you'll see your drug-allergy interactions. You'll see your drug-drug interactions. Well, the day will come, I believe, that we're going to have genetic information put into our pharmacy software, so we'll get an interaction report based on drug and gene interactions. So it is coming down the line. So let's develop some technology that incorporates that into our software today. So now I want to kind of take a moment. We all know these next few slides. We all understand this, but I want to make sure we're on the same page moving forward. So I kind of want to discuss real quick why we use the drugs we use today. So if you think about it, many diseases have multiple drugs that would work to cure or control a certain disease. But why do we pick one drug over the other? So take a minute, just ponder this. Why do we choose one drug off the shelf versus the other when we're doing guideline-based therapy? So just think about it just a moment. Some of you might be thinking of cost plays a major factor, and absolutely that does. Other people are probably thinking, hey, maybe there has been some adverse reactions with one particular drug, so we're going to stay away from that and go to another one. These are all great options, but I kind of want to tailor into clinical studies. So when we are in the past, there has been landmark trials that have shown why we use one drug over the other. Maybe one gets more of a benefit from it, more patients benefit from it, so we kind of use that as our first-line therapy, and we kind of reserve other drugs for second-line therapy and third-line and so forth. So there's been a lot of landmark trials, and that's kind of how we do it. So I kind of use an analogy here, and I want to do a session clinical trial. So I wanted to test out how our chat room board is working, and because I'll be asking multiple choice questions later on in the presentation. So this is a good chance to kind of practice that, and I want to see if it works okay. So what I typically do is a candy experiment. We're going to run our own clinical trial. And say I want to study high blood pressure medications. So to do that, if I'm running this research, I'm going to grab a bunch of people with high blood pressure to use them as my study subjects. And then I'm going to give them drug A, which in this case will be a Hershey's Kiss, or drug B, which in this case would be a Starburst. Now, in no way am I saying that medication is drugs. I'm just kind of using this as an analogy here. So if you wouldn't mind, could you please, if you're able to, in the chat box, type in which candy you like better, either Hershey's Kiss and Starburst. I'm going to take a poll here. So we'll hopefully open it up and see what we got. Wow, we have a lot of chocolate fans out there. I'm seeing a lot of Hershey's Kiss, a few Starbursts. Some people are probably picking the Starburst because you get two pieces of candy in a wrapper instead of just the one. Okay, great. Thank you all for those of you that responded. Through that, I probably saw a good, probably 60%, maybe 70% of you pick the Hershey's Kiss. So great. So let's say we're still in this clinical trial mode, and I've given both drugs to each of my subjects. And let's say if you pick the Hershey's Kiss, let's say that Hershey's Kiss worked better for you to control your blood pressure. If you pick the Starburst, then the Starburst worked better to control your blood pressure. So at the end of my study here, I've concluded it, and I'm looking at my results, and I've noticed that the Hershey's Kiss has actually lowered the majority of people's blood pressure down by 70% to 30%. So if I'm going to publish my results, I'm going to say that 70% of my patient population responded better to Hershey's Kiss than Starburst. So therefore, if I'm writing clinical guidelines, I'm going to say drug A or the first option should be Hershey's Kiss, and we'll reserve Starburst for second-line therapy. And I'm going to publish my results. They're going to go out to everyone to read, right? So we read these results, and then we apply them to clinical practice. But if we think about it, there's a problem that underlies this situation. This problem comes from, yes, while a majority of people responded better to Hershey's Kiss, there's still a significant population portion that responded to Starburst. So maybe that this Hershey's Kiss will not work better for everyone. There's still 30% of our population that's going to need Starburst as first-line therapy. So right now we're kind of using a one-drug-fits-all approach. Well, this is where we can use genetics to determine which medication will work best. Why waste our time on Hershey's Kisses for people that respond better to Starburst? So that's kind of the analogy I wanted to play here and drive home this point, is that we all work differently. Just like we chose which candy we like the best, our genes choose which drugs work the best. So I apologize for everyone out there. Since this is a webinar, I can't pass out candy. I usually pass out candy here, so you'd be benefiting from either chocolate or some fruit type of candy. So sorry about that, but we'll move on from there. So I kind of want to go on to some definitions here. So kind of just so we're all on the same page, pharmacology, by definition, is the science of drugs. And if we take a look at the definitions of genomics, it's the study of genes and their functions. So putting those two together, we get pharmacogenomics being defined as the study of how genes affect an individual's response to drugs. And a lot of people seem to get confused when we use the terms pharmacogenetics or pharmacogenomics. These are kind of used in place of each other quite frequently, but there is a slight difference between the two definitions. So if we look at pharmacogenetics, it's the study of a single gene involved in response to a drug. Genomics is a slightly different concept, where we're taking all the genes in a genome involved into a drug response. So if we're considering all the genes in a person, we're really looking at pharmacogenomics. Or if we're looking at just one gene, it's pharmacogenetics. So just a slight definition to kind of keep these two separate. We'll stay on the same page here. So how are we using pharmacogenomics and pharmacy practice today? Some of you are probably quite familiar with this. If you're new to genetics, hopefully this is a reason why we're paying attention. Pharmacogenomics right now is currently being used to understand an individual's metabolism. That's one route. We're going to look at their genes and see if a particular drug is being metabolized either too slow or too fast. We can determine dosing from this, or we can determine maybe we need another medication. It's also being used to determine drug responses and adverse reactions. Right now, with simvastatin out there, there is a test where we can check a specific gene and see if a person is more susceptible for some of the myopathy effects that come with some statins. Last but not least, we're using pharmacogenomics to develop new drugs. Drugs coming out in the market will look at a specific portion of a population, and if a certain percentages have some type of genetic mutation, that these people need a new drug, some drugs may come out to help with this certain patient population. But overall, we're using them to improve safety and efficacy of drugs we have on the market. So I want to take a second to make sure we're all on the same page and just define a couple of terms that I'll be using throughout the rest of this presentation. First, I want to talk about alleles. So there's some certain terminology out there, and you'll see these on your page here: loss of function, reduced function, normal function, and gain of function. So if we want to take a look at an allele is an alternative version of the same gene inherited from each parent. So you'll get one from your mother and one from your father, and they'll come up to make a certain type of gene. So if allele is defined as a loss of function, this means there is a pretty intuitive, there's a reduced in function of that allele, so it's not going to work as well. So if it's metabolizing a drug, it's going to be very, very slow. A loss of function is almost where it has no function at all. It might just be hanging around and not metabolizing a drug. Reduced function, it has a little bit more function than loss of function, but it's still not going to work like normal. There's still going to be a slow drug metabolism with this type of allele. Next, the normal functioning allele. These are alleles that we can predict what type of response we'll get with a drug based on its metabolism. The enzyme is going to work how we expect it to. It's going to metabolize the drug how we expect it to. It's going to work normally. The last but not least is a gain of function allele. If an allele is a gain of function, that means it's going to work very, very quickly to metabolize the drug. So it may be in the body and out of it real quick. So these people will need to make sure we give them a higher concentration of a dose because they are going to metabolize it so quickly. So those are the terms of alleles, but remember I said you're getting one from your mother and one from your father, right? So if you may get a situation where you'll have a reduced function allele from your mother and a normal function allele from your father. So we have to put these two together to make our gene. So what happens when we get these two different types of alleles coming together? So that comes into our next slide here. We have four different terms to introduce. I hope I'm not burdening you all with different terms, but these are kind of important moving forward. So an ultra-rapid metabolizer, what's it mean if you're ultra-rapid? So that is an individual with a gain-of-function allele from either parent. Maybe they have two gain-of-functions, maybe they just have one gain-of-function and one normal, but for some reason they get that gain-of-function allele from mother or father, so that means they're going to metabolize a drug super quick and they'll need higher concentrations of a drug. An extensive metabolizer, or quote-unquote normal metabolizer, I'll use normal throughout the rest of the presentation, this is an individual with two normal function alleles. So they got a normal function from mom, normal function from dad. We can predict what the dose response is in the metabolism of a specific drug. An intermediate metabolizer is a little slower metabolizer. That means they got one allele from mother that's maybe a loss of function, and they got one from dad that's a normal function. So it's going to work slightly slower in a person's body, so maybe we give them less of a drug. It's still a functioning gene or functioning enzyme, but it's not going to metabolize a drug as quickly as a normal or an ultra-rapid would. Poor metabolizers are last. Maybe they got two reduced functions or two loss of function alleles from their parents, so therefore we may need to pick another drug because this drug's not going to get metabolized well. So those are kind of the terms. I'll use these four definitions throughout the rest of the presentation, the ultra-rapid, extensive, intermediate, and poor metabolizer. So we'll use those going forward. So now let's change gears. I want to introduce some medications that are probably on your shelves right now that have genetic components to them. The FDA has some information in their package inserts that are required. So I have highlighted three here, clopidogrel, codeine, and warfarin that we're going to be touching on. This is by no means an extensive list. There is quite a few more drugs out there that are affected by genetics, but I just wanted to put a list up here to kind of get your wheels turning, to see some of these drugs on your shelves and kind of have you realize that there are drugs out there that we need to have genetic information for. One of the ones I wanted to point out to you here as well that we're not going to go over today but that does have a genetic component to it is simvastatin. I kind of talked earlier, there's a genetic component out there. If we look at a specific gene, we can tell if they're going to have these muscle cramps or pains involved. So there is an adverse reaction genetic test we can do for that. We're not going to touch on that today. We'll touch on the other three. So the first one I want to talk about is clopidogrel. There's been a lot of talk in the genetic community about this medication. Some of you on the phone may be very familiar with this. I kind of want to touch it to those that have not had much exposure to genetics. But as we all know, clopidogrel is a prodrug, so it needs to be activated in order to get its therapeutic effect. So what gene activates this medication? So as you can see here, CYP2C19 is the enzyme that's responsible for this activation. So within our body, we all have the CYP2C19 enzyme, but we all have them working in different functions. So what do I mean by that? As I talked about before, some of us may be an ultra-rapid metabolizer. So that means this enzyme is going to work very quickly to metabolize this inactive drug to the active one. So we'll get quick turnaround. This drug is going to work very quickly. On the contrary, if someone is a poor metabolizer, their enzyme is not working very well, this drug is going to stay around in this inactive form for a very, very long time, if not holistically. So this drug is not going to get converted to active. Basically, this patient is taking a placebo medication. They're getting no therapeutic effect from it. So we're very concerned about this because we all know the importance of clopidogrel and why the patients are on this medication. And if we don't have the metabolizing enzyme working to get the active metabolite, then this patient's not going to get any benefit. They might end up with a bad serious reaction, and they're going to go wind up right back in the hospital. So I kind of want to show you some statistics that I found. Up to 30% of patients on clopidogrel carry some genetic variants, and you can see the breakdown per race on who carries the genetic variances. And as you can see, in 2010, there was a black box warning that came out that said up to 14% of Americans are poor metabolizers, and the FDA recommends alternative treatment. So these patients are basically taking a placebo medication, and we don't even know anything about it. But as I said before, 30% carry a genetic variant. So next time you are filling clopidogrel, think about it for the next 10 fills. Three times you're filling that medication for a patient, and it's basically not going to work the way it's intended to. And 14% are getting no effect from this medication. So just think about that next time you're filling these medications. There is something, we need to be able to do something to get sure, to make sure these patients are on the right medication. And that's through genetic testing. So this is a very important piece where pharmacists can step in and get genetic testing for our patients and then dose or choose a medication that's best for them. So here is a list of what happens when we test a patient for clopidogrel. So as I said before, there is different forms. There is an ultra-rapid metabolizer, an extensive, an intermediate, and a poor. And you can kind of see the percentage breakdown with these. So if a patient is an ultra-rapid metabolizer, I won't go into all these numbers because it can get pretty confusing if we dive into it too long, and I don't want to keep you here for a few hours or just 1 hour. So we'll just say if someone's an ultra-rapid metabolizer, that means that there is this increased platelet inhibition, but the therapeutic recommendation is to kind of use labeled indications. Some papers out there reporting maybe we need to increase dose amount on clopidogrel, that sort of thing. Extensive metabolizer is normal platelet inhibition, and just normal dosing is appropriate here. I want to point down to the poor metabolizers. These are individuals carrying two loss of function alleles. So what the recommendation on this is to use alternative platelet therapy. So they recommend prasugrel or ticagrelor. So if you have genetic testing for your patients, they come back with this poor metabolizing enzyme, we need to get them switched. They are basically taking a placebo medication. I have another slide here I want to point out that is pretty helpful. I really like this slide here. So if we know the CYP2-19 results for a patient, they fall into one of the four following categories, and they have their star one qualities that I didn't get into much detail. But basically, if they come back as an ultra-rapid or an extensive metabolizer, we need to use the standard dosing of clopidogrel. If they are intermediate or poor, we need to consider alternative platelet therapy, and they've listed two medications we need to switch to. So maybe some of you have done this already. Maybe you have genetic testing in your pharmacy. Maybe you have done the switch. I have actually seen the switch happen before, and I've actually recommended a switch before, and it was pretty rewarding knowing that the patient was not getting put on a medication that was going to do nothing for them. So I felt like I was really taking ownership in this patient's life and making sure they are on the right medication for their genetic testing results. So I'll kind of go away from clopidogrel a little bit, introduce our next medication. This is codeine, and we know that codeine is a substrate for a specific enzyme called CYP2D6. So codeine is actually, there is a methyl group off to the oxygen side that CYP2D6 works on. It takes this off and converts it to morphine, and this is where we get our analgesic effects from. So if a patient is a CYP2D6 poor metabolizer, that means this methyl group is not coming off, and that means they're not converting it to morphine, and so they're going to get no pain effect. On the opposite side, if someone's CYP2D6 is an ultra-rapid metabolizer, this methyl group is going to come up very, very quick, and they may get too much morphine in their body, and it's going to lead to morphine toxicity. So this could be a problem in itself. If we don't know they're an ultra-rapid metabolizer, we could be overdosing them and not even knowing it. So I want to show you this next slide here, just to kind of drive home this point. If the CYP2D6 is non-functional, they're not going to get any analgesic effect. So I have actually gone through genetic testing myself. I have found out that I am a poor metabolizer of CYP2D6. So my report says, hey Nick, you can't take codeine because it's not going to be converted into morphine, and you're going to get no benefit from it. So now I know when I go to the doctor, let's say if I break a leg, heaven forbid, in the future, I know not to get certain medications that are go through the CYP2D, 2D6 metabolizing pathway. That way we're making sure I'm on the right medication and not on something that's going to give me no benefit. On the contrary, the ultra-rapid 2D6, we've talked about that morphine toxicity. We're going to get too much conversion from codeine to morphine. That'll lead to an overdose, respiratory problems, and the like. So actually, in 2013, a black box warning was introduced, and it advises against the use of codeine-containing products in children who are ultra-rapid metabolizers. Because these children are so susceptible to this toxicity, we said, hey, we need to probably stay away from the codeine pain medications. Let's get something that is a little different just so we can avoid this toxicity problem in itself. So I kind of want to show you another chart here, kind of like we did on clopidogrel. It breaks it down to the ultra-rapid, the extensive, the intermediate, and poor metabolizer, and it kind of gives you a recommendation on what to do based on their genetic results. So if someone, like I said, is an ultra-rapid metabolizer, we're going to avoid codeine use due to potential toxicity. And they give you a list of medications to kind of avoid and some to use in this alternative opioids category here. Same thing with the poor metabolizer. If they're not getting any effect for the morphine, we need to avoid codeine use due to lack of efficacy as well, and it gives you a list of things to choose from. And these lists I've shown you come from PharmGKB. It's a website that uses CPIC guidelines. These are guidelines for genetics based on drugs. It's a very, very good website. I'll show you this website here in the future of this presentation, but this is where these recommendations are coming from. They're based on sound recommendations from CPIC guidelines. Last one I want to go over with you guys today is warfarin. So this one actually has two genetic components to it. So we all know that warfarin is an effective anticoagulant because it inhibits vitamin K epoxide reductase, or this VKOR enzyme, resulting in a decreased activity of vitamin K, which reduces synthesis of clotting factors. So it's a very, very good anticoagulant. So we kind of need to pay attention to this enzyme VKOR. Why do we need to do that? Well, some individuals produce lower amounts of this enzyme, VKOR, and then are more sensitive to warfarin. So kind of the analogy I use for here, say if you had 10 of these enzymes in your body, and you have a person that has a decreased amount, say they only have 5, you would need less warfarin for your sensitivity of this enzyme. Less warfarin will work. If you have too much warfarin, you're going to overburden this VKOR, and you'll lead to an increase in bleeding. The last one I want to point out here is the CYP2C9 part. This is the metabolizing enzyme to get this drug out of your body. So when you take this warfarin chemical, you'll see that there's an R and S here. This means it comes in a 50-50 racemic mixture of R and S enantiomers. I don't want to get too much into it, but what I want to talk about is the S version here on the right side. This is the more potent form of warfarin, and it's actually 5 times more potent than the R version. So we're kind of worried about this one a lot more, and it goes through one CYP enzyme. So that one is CYP2C9. We need to worry about this because some individuals have alleles that result in a decreased clearance of this drug, meaning it's going to stay in this form for a lot, lot longer, and there's more active drug. It's not being metabolized out of your body. So this is important for those individuals that have a decrease in clearance. We need to give them less of a drug as well, so we don't have too much of that drug sitting around in our bodies causing too much bleeding. So we need to take into account both CYP2C9 and VKOR when we dose patients. If we know genetic information on a patient before they get put on warfarin, we can guess what their initial starting dose would be based on their genetic profile. So how do we do that? So actually, if you take a peek on your shelf and you grab a bottle of warfarin, look at that package insert. Open it up. There is genetic information dosing in those package inserts, and it kind of looks like this. They give you a recommended daily warfarin dose to achieve therapeutic INR based on those two enzymes we just discussed. So let me orient you to this chart so when you take out your package inserts, you kind of know what you're looking at. This is the VKOR section. So if you think back, that is this enzyme right here. So like I said before, there's individuals that produce lower amounts of VKOR. so they are more sensitive. So if you see this top category, GG is the normal, quote-unquote normal enzyme type with this. We expect normal activity with this. However, if a patient gets an A or a double A within their VKOR, that means that they are producing lower amounts of that VKOR, more sensitive. That means we need less drug. So if we take a look down this list, as you go down and add those AA, you're going to get a decrease in the amount of warfarin dosing you need per day. So that's very important to check out. Last is the the CYP2C9. So like I said before, some individuals have a decreased clearance of the drug. So star 1 is normal clearance. If we start adding these 2s or 3s, then we're going to get those decrease in clearance. So if we start out with star 1, we expect normal metabolism. Let's start with a 5 to 7 milligrams per day dosing. But if we introduce these CYP2C9 star 2s and star 3s, we are not going to get the metabolism we want, so we need less drug. So if we go across the table like this, you'll see that the dosing amounts are decreased because that enzyme to metabolize that drug out of your body is not working as well. So these patients will benefit from a lower dose. So to kind of put this together, we need to look at both VKOR and CYP2C9. You'll see down here at the bottom, these are patients that have lower amounts of VKOR and their metabolizing enzymes are decreased. So there's going to be a lot of drug in the body. So they will need a significantly lower dose per day for this patient. So even 0.5 milligrams of warfarin a day is used in some individuals, and that's a small amount that most of us are used to. But some, if they're star 3, and if they're AA, we need to get them on this amount of warfarin dosing. So go check your bottle of warfarin on the shelf, pull up the package insert. You'll see this on the shelf, and we'll go from there. Let's see. So I talked about a resource before, this PharmGKB. You can just Google this. This will pull up this website, and it's a very, very good resource. I look at it all the time. It includes the CPIC guidelines for dosing with genetic information. Very good resource. I want to show you a couple of screenshots I took. They have all the medications that have genetic components to them, and they have it listed in alphabetical order here if you go to the download section tab at the top. They have all the medications that we have genetic information for, and they'll list it down. So I have clicked on the A medications. They have Abacavir, and it continues to go down based on genetic information. So let me pull one of these up for you. I have clopidogrel pulled up, and remember we talked about CYP2C19 component. So you can type in what their alleles are. So for this one, if you type in star 1, so they got one from mom, one from dad, it'll tell you the implications. So it's normal platelet inhibition. It'll go down and give you recommendations. So this one says we need to do normal, the label recommendation of dosing and administration, and it'll give you the classification of recommendation. So this is a strong recommendation as posted by CPIC guidelines. So you can play with this. You can put in different star amounts. Maybe if you want to put a star 1, star 17, and it'll tell you down here your ultra-rapid metabolizer and you need to do this dosing and so on and so forth. You can do this with any drug. Very, very cool website. I recommend you check it out. So I want to go into a quick question here. I see there's a question in our chat box. Star 1, is normal father and normal mother correct? So that is based on clopidogrel. Yes, that is correct. If you get a star 1 for clopidogrel, that is a normal metabolizing enzyme. We should expect normal conversion from the prodrug to active drug and so forth. Usually star 1 is correct for most drugs, but as you can see, if we hop back a couple of slides here, you'll see the stars. This is the clopidogrel slide. You'll see star 1s and star 17s and star 2s and 3s all across. This is different for a majority of drugs. If I hop across to this one is the codeine one, you'll see some star 41s pop up, some star 5s and 6s. So you'll really need to kind of use this resource to kind of gauge if this is a decrease in function allele or if it's an increase in function, that sort of thing. So I want to hop back to our question here. Which of the following medications are not affected by a patient's genetic makeup? Is it warfarin, clopidogrel, codeine, simvastatin, or all of the above are affected? So if you want to take a second to pop in your response. So that's great. I'm seeing a lot of E's, and that is the correct answer. All the above are affected by a patient's genetic makeup. We went over the warfarin. We went over clopidogrel. Went over codeine. I saw some answers for simvastatin. Yes, we didn't have time to go over this, but it does have a genetic component to it. Like I said before, it is the adverse reaction of simvastatins. We can test this specific enzyme to see if a patient is more susceptible to the side effects of pain in the legs and that sort of thing. That wasn't covered in this section today, but there is information on there. If you go to that PharmGKB website, you can click on simvastatin, and it'll tell you what gene is affected and go into information based on that. So great job. I have one more question here. Quickly, RS is a 64-year-old who will be initiating warfarin due to AFib. RS's doctor knows about the variability with warfarin dosing and recognizes there's a genetic component to it. So the doctor learned from RS she already had genetic testing done previously, and you have a copy of the results as a pharmacist. RS's doctor decides to call you for a consultation to discuss her results and ask you for a recommendation on the dosing. After you review RS's genetic results, you see her CYP2C9 is a star 2, star 3, and her VKOR1 is an AA. Which of the following would you recommend to the doctor is the most appropriate starting dose for RS? So let's go back. I'll pull up my guidelines here. It was star 2, star 3, and AA. So let's go back to our cheat sheet here. So if we look at star 2, star 3, AA, it is 0.5 to 2 milligrams a day is the recommendation. So if we have 0.5 to 2 on our heads, we pop back over to the question. The answer in this case is D. So very good job. I'm seeing a lot of D's in there. So it would be appropriate to start this patient on 1 milligram per day. So great job. So now I kind of want to take a little change in direction here. We talked about some drugs. I didn't want to go into too much more than three. Let's change it to how can we bring genetic testing into our pharmacies. So to start that, I wanted to bring up a study we did here at Uptown Pharmacy. We have a resident that comes in each year, and part of their residency is to complete a research project. So a couple years ago, one of our residents did a survey-based research project where we wanted to bring in genetic service to our pharmacy. We just didn't know what the need was from the community. So we did a survey to patients. And asked them a few questions, and we got their answers, and we put them together in tables. The question was, have you ever had genetic testing done for a health condition before? Out of 98 responses, 83 of them had not had genetic testing done, and 6% were unsure. So only 11% of our patient population had some type of genetic testing done. Now, 11% may surprise you. That may be more than what we were expecting. But as you can see, there is a lot of potential out there. 89% of people, at least in our area, had not had genetic testing done before, so there was a great need for it. We asked them another question. On a scale of 1 to 5, how interested would you be in genetic testing? And we found out that if it improves medication use, there was a lot more interest in genetic testing. So if we went to a patient and said, hey, you are on clopidogrel, there is a 30% chance that you have a variance to this and you may not benefit from this drug, and there's a slight potential may not be working like it should for you. So if we present them with this opportunity, we say, hey, we should test your enzyme, make sure it's working appropriately, and tell the patient we could improve this use, we could get you on a drug that worked best for you, they were more responsive to this. But you can see overall, all three of them were above average in interest of genetic testing. So there was interest in our community. Another question, the last question I want to present to you guys is factors increasing interest in paying for pharmacogenetic services. So if the patients are interested, are they willing to pay for it? And if so, why are they willing to pay for it? And we found out that if the results affect their quality of life, if they're not getting the side effects, if they know or they're reassured they're on the right medication, the right dose, then they're more willing to pay for services you're able to provide. So if we're able to present these opportunities to patients in this route, we're going to be able to affect your quality of life. We're going to be able to improve it. We're going to let you sleep well at night knowing you're on the right drugs, right dosing, not going to cause you any side effects. They're willing to pay for these services. So there's a great potential out there. So I kind of want to open this up to group participation. I know most of you guys are probably muted on your phone calls. But what potential do you see for genetic testing in your community? Maybe think about it. If you want to put something down there in the chat box, say like you have great potential or you don't think it's a good potential in your area, feel free to write your responses in there or just think about it. Do you think genetic testing, do you think your patients and your pharmacy that you see day after day would be interested in genetic testing? So I see some people are writing in there. Think about it for just a moment. So I'm seeing a lot of people saying good potential. Someone says money-making opportunity too. That's a great, great answer there. Remember back to the APHA's article, they said they needed to, we need to make a model and we need to make sure it's viable. So it's long-lasting. Both our patients are benefiting from it, but also ourselves are able to pay for our time and our service. I see some primarily elderly population. Costs will be inhibitive. Yep, this is true. The pricing is still kind of expensive for some of these companies. Sometimes insurance covers it, sometimes not. So I'll kind of get into some of those. But, yeah, seeing with some of the answers there is great potential here. So I want to move on to genetic testing in pharmacies. I've listed here for you some genetic testing groups that are out there in the market. This is technically not an inclusive list, but I wanted to put some up here that pharmacy could have a role in. So here's a list if you want to look into some type of genetic testing pharmacy or genetic testing services you can implement in your pharmacy. I've highlighted two, Genelex and Wright. I'm going to go over these in our presentation here shortly. I kind of wanted to highlight these to kind of show you what's out there and how they function differently, the payment model set up, how we go about doing it. I did highlight Harmonix, or I starred Harmonix down here. Some of you might have heard of Harmonix, some of you have not, so I kind of want to go into this real quick. So Rite Aid Pharmacy actually brought in this genetic service to their shelves. What this was is a saliva sample that we send into a company and patients get their genetic results. And they had four different tests. You could test for ADHD medications, pain, platelets, and statins. They were both different payment models and the patient would purchase this. We'd help them with the swab. We'd send it out to the company and then the information would go directly to the patient. But what happened was in February of this year, the FDA actually went into Harmonix headquarters and said that what they're doing is direct-to-consumer information. So when they got the genetic results available, they sent it right to the patient. There was no middleman, no physician, no pharmacist, no one to explain the results to them, and this got them in trouble, and the FDA asked Harmonix to stop accepting tests, and they kind of went out of business because of this. You'll see this with other genetic testing services out there. The FDA is catching wind of something that is not okay in their standards, and they're shutting them down. So this is something to always be cognizant of, making sure you are picking a program that is that there's no direct to consumer advertising or information giving information to them directly without a middleman. So I kind of wanted to explain a little bit why the FDA has a problem with some of these companies. So these commercially genetic companies are considered quote-unquote laboratory-developed tests, or LDTs. The FDA does not regulate LDTs, or these tests. So they use the term quote-unquote enforcement discretion with these companies, basically meaning they will let these companies come to market and will later decide on if and how to punish a company if they see fit. If they don't like their model, they can shut them down. So they don't really regulate these companies quite yet. But in 2010, the FDA came out with a statement saying they wanted to crack down more on these companies. They are slowly starting to do so, and that happened to Harmonix. So when you go to pick a company, do your research. Make sure that the model is appropriate. Make sure that the information, the genetic information, doesn't go directly to the patient. Make sure there's a middleman if we're worrying about drugs and how they can metabolize them differently than other people. But I do want to highlight two real fast. Genelex is the first one we'll go into. So the available tests for Genelex, they have different panels. It's kind of like an a la carte menu where you're going to choose which enzyme you want to test. So they have individual tests here from your CYP2C9, your CYP2C19, 2D6, those three we actually talked about in this presentation. You can actually just pick one of these and have it tested, get the results back, and dose your medications appropriately. They also have panels over here that they couple these enzymes together, so they'll test even more enzymes to get information on this. So kind of what they set up as a payment model, there is they accept cash or they accept insurance. Quickly on the insurance, private insurance will pay for some genetic testing if there's an adverse drug reaction potential or if there's a lack of response for a medication, if it's for pain management, cancer management, or management of many comorbid conditions. And you'll also see that Medicare varies by plan. Medicare Advantage typically does cover these tests. Traditional Medicare is kind of iffy. So I have a little chart over here that says the percentage coverage based on the plan that the patient has. So you'll see Humana is included, United Healthcare is included, Aetna is included, the 75% coverage. So it would be like a test per test basis on if a insurance will cover a certain test panel. So this is kind of for your benefit. If you'd like to look into them a little bit more, this is kind of the way they do it. They do accept cash and insurance, so it's a good way for options for insurance. This is the report you would get from Genelex. This is the panel test I showed you from before, so they coupled five different enzymes in here, and they list which enzyme is which. So you'll see that CYP2D6 for this patient is an intermediate metabolizer. CYP2C19 is a poor, and it keeps going down the list, and it gives you the genotype over here to the side. So it's a pretty nice report. They also go into, they break it down based on the medications the patient is on. So they'll show you the impact of these. So for this one, for codeine, remember they were CYP2D6 intermediate metabolizer. They said, hey, wait a second, this may not be appropriate for the patient. They list potential alternatives to codeine listed here. So you kind of make sure the patient is on the right medication. But I kind of want to just show you these two pages at the sample report Genelex would give after their testing has been completed. We'll take a quick dive into Wright is another genetic company. They market a lot to pharmacies. They do show up at trade shows. They might be coming to NCPA's trade show. I'm not quite sure. But they have been to other ones. Fairly new company. What you do is it's a full test panel. It's not an a la carte like Genelex was. They test a big number of alleles and genes, and it covers over 200-plus prescription over-the-counter medications. What you do is you type in the patient's medications they're on. They list them at top, and based on their genetic report, they list whether they can take the medications before. So as you can see, the patient is on simvastatin here. They found out that there is a myopathy risk based on the genetic information, so we should stay away from this. Let's choose another statin medication. They do that for all the other drugs that the patient is on. They also give a report based on all the genes they tested. So here's all the genes, the complete list, their genotype, whether they're normal, rapid, poor metabolizer, and the alleles that they tested. So this is a good report for that as well. And then they go on to list other drugs that the patient is not necessarily on but could be affected based on genetic profile. So they break it up to category of medication, such as the NSAIDs. So with this patient, based on the genetic profile, all the medications listed in this section would be good for the patient to use. They break into three categories, ones they should stay away from, ones used with caution, and ones that they can use with standard precaution, but we can pretty much predict that they'll have a normal response to it. Same thing with the opioids. We found out that this person can't take codeine, so we should pick something from the other list that's in the green check mark box as well. So I just wanted to kind of show you these results reports for both of these companies, but do your research, make sure their model is okay, and kind of ask around to see if the FDA likes what they're doing or if not, because remember, the FDA is using enforcement discretion, so they're not regulating them now, but they may step in if they have to. So another question here, which of the following statements is false? So is it A, Harmonix is not accepting tests at this time, B, Wright can bill a patient's insurance for genetic testing, C, Genelex allows patients to pay cash for genetic testing, and D, all the above are true. And before I have you respond to all of these, I forgot to point out that this will be a hard question to answer because I didn't point out something specific. With Wright itself, they're not accepting insurance payment at this time. Only Genelex is of the two I've talked about. Wright is a cash-based system. They also use HSA, FSA accounts, so people could use those towards the end of the year. They can use those accounts. But right now, they're not set up to bill insurance. So I'm sorry for the trick in this one. Let's see what people are responding. So the correct answer here is B. Harmonix currently is not accepting tests at this time. FDA stepped in and told them to stop doing so because they didn't like their model. Genelex does allow patients to pay cash, but remember we can also bill insurance for these. Right now is just a cash-based system, so they are not accepting insurance at this time. So lastly, I want to dive into marketing of this real quick because you'll want to do this. When you bring in a service to your pharmacy, you want to let people know about it. So there's internal marketing, community marketing, and physician office marketing. So real quick on how to do this. For internal, make sure you create a display. Make sure people can see your product. Include a sign. Gabe Trahan of NCPA always says you need to make a sign for your display to know what the patients know what you're selling. Put stuff in bag stuffers. Initiate conversation to use real-life examples. So with this, I want to give you a couple of examples on how to start the conversation. Maybe you notice the patient's meds keep changing, so you walk up to them and say, hey, I've noticed you've been switching your doctor's been switching your meds as some of these not working well for you, and kind of start it that way and lead into, hey, genetics testing could be used to help you pick the right drug, that sort of thing. But what if you get objection from a patient? Say it's a cash-based system product and they don't want to pay cash for it. How do you handle this? Maybe a patient says they don't need the test. You can respond by saying, no one knows if they're going to need a new med now. No one is immune from pain or from acid reflux or depression, anxiety. If you get genetic testing now, you'll have a blueprint for your medications in the future if needed. So if you get it tested now, you know you can't take codeine like myself. You know to stay away from codeine in the future. So it's kind of a preventative thing. So you can kind of present it that way. Marketing to the community, you want to make sure your community gets excited about this because it's a brand new type of service that pharmacies are just now bringing into stores. Add it to your website, Facebook, Twitter account, whatever you have. Make sure people know about it. Community outreach events. Go out to the local senior center or assisted living facility and do a quick presentation on what is genetics and how can it be used to help them. Contact reporters or press release. Put it in the newspaper, talk to your local reporter, get them excited about it, and have them come to your pharmacy to show them what cool service you're providing to your patient population. Marketing to physician offices. APHA wants to have a team model with pharmacogenomics and not just having pharmacists take over it. Get the physicians involved. Do some doctor detailing. Maybe a lot of you do it now where you go to doctors and talk about your immunization programs or pain management programs, hormone therapy replacement programs. Go out and do this with pharmacogenomics. Make a list of your top 10 to 15 doctors in your area and drop off information about the service. Initiate those conversations. One way you can initiate it is saying something. You guys know that the White House is coming out with this precision medicine statement. Have them start out your conversation with, have you figured out how to integrate precision medicine to your practice yet? Can I help you do so? I can bring the knowledge of drugs and genes to your practice. But as a lot of you are probably thinking, some physicians will object to this as well. So how do you handle physician objection? Say your physician responds that their patients are not having any problems on their current medications. You can respond that your patients may be put on medications in the future, like pain meds or depression meds, and it would be great to know what their genetic makeup is now so we choose the right medication for them so we're not wasting time in the future. Maybe your physician is concerned with protection of genetic information. Maybe if the insurance companies will get a hold of it, they'll discriminate against them. Well, you can reassure them that there is a federal law in place. It's called the Genetic Information Non-Discriminatory Act, or GINA. It came out in 2008, and this is to protect discrimination from health insurance companies and employment based off an insurance genetic results. So there is some protection out there for them, so you can respond in that manner. But this brings me to the end of the presentation. I hope you were able to gain a good knowledge of what, how genetics affect metabolism medications are on the market now and then are on the market to come. Hopefully you're able to get some good ideas. If you have genetics as a passion and you want to bring it to your pharmacy, you think your community can benefit from it, look into those companies. See which one will work best for you, which one has a good viable payment model for yourself and one that you can keep long-lasting. So look into those, bring it to your community, and make sure you advertise. Advertise. Make sure your patients know about the service. Don't just put it on yourself and let it collect dust. So with that, I want to thank you all for participating in today's, and I'll hand it back over. Is Sue here?
Yep. Can you hear me now?
Oh, we can hear you.
I'm sorry. I started speaking and had myself on mute. Realizing that we're at the very top of the hour, I need to give instructions on how to claim credit for CE. CE is available for pharmacists and for pharmacy technicians by going to www.ncpalearn.org. So ncpalearn.org. If you previously had done CE with NCPA through pharmacistelink.com, you can use that same username with a temporary password ncpa2016. Otherwise, you'll create a new account at ncpalearn.org. You'll choose from the live CE in the menu, and then you'll need the access code genetics, and that's all lowercase, GENETICS. The deadline for claiming credit is September 21st, 2016. I will, and again, the access code is genetics. Nick, if you had a chance to look, I flagged four questions for you. I'll go back and grab a couple others that have come in at the end here. I'm going to ask that you hold off from stating the product that you use. If anybody would like to contact you afterwards, your contact information is here on the screen. But thank you so much for an excellent presentation on the options and the reasons for including pharmacogenomics in your practice. So I'll let you handle some of those questions.
Sure, I'd love to do so. So I will refrain from the one that we did bring into our pharmacy, but we're really excited about it. The first question is from Heather. I see the question is, we are doing point-of-care testing. Maybe this can fit into this program. That's a very good opportunity. A lot of these genetic testing services do a saliva swab. So if you just put this with the rest of your point of care, you can do your saliva testing back there. Most of the companies ask that you send in your swab to their company so they can run the genetic testing. So just sending it in that way, there's to my knowledge, I'm not sure of too many point-of-care machines that are available to purchase to put in your pharmacy to do the testing in-house. A lot of them are sending them out to a some type of company to get it tested. So, but it is a good way to put that in there. Next question, I have a large Medicaid patient share. Is this a cash pay service or insurance reimbursing for this? As I said before, a lot of these companies are cash based. Some do bill insurance. Medicare is a big part of this, like the Medicare Advantage plans, traditional Medicare plans. Medicaid, I haven't seen too much, but don't quote me on that. You'd have to look into the individual genetic service company themselves to see if Medicaid does play a role in that that service. The next question is, we've been approached by a company to do a research study with oral swabbing, but we are concerned about the legality of implementation, the CLIA waiver required. So some of these companies, that is a very good point. We don't want to kind of break any rules there. So when a patient does want to do a swab through you, a lot of genetic companies that sell you their service say to have the patient do the swab themselves. So bring them back to the back room to do the consultation. Hand them the swab, let them swab themselves, and put it in the package to send off, kind of making sure that we don't have a role in that swabbing case to kind of avoid that. So that's also genetic company specific in itself too. So you'll want to look into that as well. The next question is, what type of payment do you get from Genelex? I am familiar with Wright. The payment with Genelex, I hesitate to talk about any money or payment that is associated with it. But if you go onto their website or inquire more, they will give you amounts of money for each service, the amount of money you may get from doing the service, and they kind of list that out. You can email someone to talk to them and get a more clear information with that. But I can't talk about any prices through this. I apologize for that. How much is a typical polypharmacy panel through Genelex via self-pay? And how many patients do you expect to have tested per year at your facility? So for the first question there, that polypharmacy panel that includes those five enzymes, the cash-based price is listed if you inquire more through them. I have seen the list price itself, so feel free to inquire more, ask them what price it is. It's not cheap, I can tell you that, so it would be beneficial to have insurance pay for it. How many patients do you expect to have tested per year at your facility? I'm hesitating to talk about it because it would kind of, I don't want to talk about the service that we have per se, but we are going out into our community. We are marketing it. We have made our display. We have created the sign. We have already gone to assisted living facility to give a presentation about genetics, and we're going to be soon marketing to reporters and putting out press releases. So we're hoping to get a good patient population to come through our doors and get tested. We're just now starting to do so. We had to go through some specific training. We've all been trained, and now we're just taking our first steps to marketing. So I don't know an exact number we're hoping to do. We're just hoping to get as much as we can. So thank you for all those questions. Hopefully I was able to answer the best I could for you. If you have any other questions for me, don't hesitate to email me. I do check it very regularly. I will get back to you as soon as I can.
Fantastic. All right, Nick, thanks so much. Once again, if you're interested, next week on Thursday, we will have a webinar on HIPAA, addressing specifically security issues, breach notification, and the HIPAA audit program that's underway. The registration link for that is there in the chat box. And with that, we will conclude. Thank you so much.